Welcome to another episode of Medical Narratives Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Gordon, a geriatrician from Toronto. In today's episode, we will be exploring the important topic of comprehensive geriatric assessment. To guide us through, we're joined by our regular guest, my colleague and friend, Dr. Barry Goldlith. Dr. Goldlith is a renowned geriatrician educator from the University Health Network in Toronto. Welcome, Barry.
Thank you.
So the question I have is, the concept of a comprehensive medical, geriatric medical assessment, it's not as if it's novel, but we in the field of geriatrics, in a sense, coined it and adopted it as our modus operandi to differentiate us from perhaps what other people do. So could you explain to the audience, most of whom are primary care physicians, what makes this different from, let's say, an internal medicine assessment, which most of us did before we went into geriatrics?
Yeah, I think one of the things I always tell my patients is that if you've reached 80 and you don't have five diagnoses, you really haven't tried. And so that complexity of our patients is what drives the need for a comprehensive geriatric assessment. So I think the easiest way is to think about some of the geriatric giants that Bernard Isaac many years ago coined. And the classic one is Falls. That was the first one that was described. And it's never the right thing to say, what is the cause of this fall? Every once in a while, you get a seizure or a cardiac event that causes a fall. But 99% of the falls in people over the age of 80, for example, are complex things that have many different factors. And rather than looking at what is the cause of this fall, you have to say, what are the factors that might contribute to this fall? And there are numerous factors. I'm going to generalize. Some of them are going to be environmental factors. Who do you have caring for you? Do you have stairs, et cetera? Others are disease states. You know, if you have heart failure, you can't provide oxygen and blood to your muscles, you're more likely to fall. Neurological factors, obviously, like a previous stroke, et cetera, are important. Then there are age-related factors, some of which are remedial, some of which are not. So rather than saying the cause of this fall is, there's a different approach. The real thing is to say, what are all the factors that could be involved in this fall? And then say, which are the ones, the next step is, which are the ones I can do something about? And then you isolate those. And then you say, which are the ones that I can do something about quickly? And those usually involve medications, intercurrent illnesses, untreated heart failure, whatever it might be. And then the last step is, what are some of the long-term factors that I'm going to need help for in trying to prevent falls in the future? And that usually includes things like rehabilitation, where you do balance training, muscle strengthening. So rather than say, what are the cause of the fall? What is the cause of the fall? You're saying, what are the factors that I can do something about first immediately and then in the long term? And so it's a very different approach, and that requires doing a very detailed assessment to find out all those factors.
Yeah, you know, Barry, I just want to interject because I remember in my early days of my career, a lot of my work when I was still doing primarily internal medicine in order to make a living, I used to do a lot of perioperative care for the orthopedic surgeons because many of their patients were elderly. And the thing that was interesting, somebody would come in with a broken hip and everybody would focus on the broken hip. And when I went to see them, I said, what happened? And they said, I don't know. I just fell off my chair. I said, fall off your chair? How do you fall off a chair? And of course, what usually happened is they had a reason that they fell off their chair, which was, as you said, something that could be remediated. I remember one in particular, they fell off the chair because they went in and out of heart block. And what they needed before the actual orthopedic surgery was a pacemaker because they were going in and out of serious heart block. But the orthopods, of course, they were focusing on the hip and figuring out what kind of surgery to do. So I think, as an example, if you just look at the immediate issue, you obviously, for our perspective, miss a lot of important things.
And that is also one of the challenges of geriatrics, despite what we're talking about, the comprehensive geriatric assessment going through everything, you can't forget those rare cases where it's heart block, a seizure that caused the fall. So you have to have that internal medicine eye on it as well. And I had a teacher, I'll give you his initials, MG, who told me when I was still a house staff and he had taken on a position at Baycrest that, you know, he would get referred younger patients with a single problem, and he felt like he was cheating OHIP by taking the money for something that was so straightforward. And it's still true. You know, I do a lot of general internal medicine simply because our clinics don't have enough people at Mount Sinai to man the clinics all the time. And we want to have continuity. So I do a lot of general medicine. And, you know, the hour and a half that you need minimum to do a comprehensive geriatric assessment, the hour for many of the general internal medicine patients is too long, particularly the ones in their 20s and 30s who are otherwise perfectly healthy and have one issue that is straightforward to address. So one of the things we know as people grow older is that the reserve of to be able to remain functional can be quite small. So it doesn't that means it doesn't take much of a perturbation in your physiology or whatever to suddenly become poorly functional. But people forget about the other side, which is that particularly if there's a couple of things that have gone wrong, that if you do a comprehensive geriatric assessment, even tiny improvements can make a huge difference because now you're above that functional level. So yes, the reserve is low, but the potential, if you pay attention to all those things to improve the person, can be incredible. And I think we've all had patients in hospital, for example, who look like they could never function, a few things done, and then you see them in follow-up a month later, dressed up, having taken public transportation to your office, who look fantastic. And so we sometimes overreact in hospital, hear the social worker say, oh, they're at their baseline now, without even knowing what their baseline was particularly, and without understanding that sometimes it takes a little bit longer to recover when you're 88 than it does when you're 28. But that doesn't mean that you can't recover. And if you do a proper comprehensive assessment, you know, we have our forms to fill in. So when residents are on the service, they can follow all the things that they have to ask about and all the things that they have to do. When you go through that and you realize, you know, we have a detailed functional assessment, you find out that a lot of the people who weren't functioning actually were functioning in their environment. And you have to spend the time to figure out what the real baseline is and allow enough time to reach that baseline.
There's something I wanted to ask you, because it's been my experience of when I speak to other physicians, and they don't quite understand why we do what we do, is the fact that we don't mind getting involved with the psychosocial and family issues that often have a major impact on how people function. And I know that when I was sort of in my internal medicine mode, especially in hospital, the idea was whenever somebody said, I'm having an issue with my family, said, we're referring to the social worker, right? Now, I'm now working not so much in a geriatric unit, but in a Toronto memory clinic, which is obviously looking at cognition, but I can't help doing what I do. And I spent about, of that hour and a half, I'd say a half hour, dealing with the family dynamics and issues and helping caregivers find strategies to cope with the challenges that they're coping with, that they say nobody ever spoke to them about it. And I find it, you know, still a kind of indication that we kind of get a sense medically that we look through a very narrow lens at people. And when you get into an ology, that ology becomes the lens. If you're a cardiologist, the lens is the heart and maybe a little bit of the veins and arteries. But when somebody says, you know, I'm really having trouble with my landlord, you say, well, send you to the social worker or something. But when you hear about it, you say, well, you know what? There may be something that you could do because you've had a lot of experience. And that's the one thing that we have had as geriatricians, a wide range of experience dealing with older people. So what else goes into the assessment that you think is...
Yeah, and I think adding that within hospital, with our crisis in beds and alternate levels of care, et cetera, our social workers are spending all their time trying to find discharge dispositions. They literally don't have the time to provide sometimes that supportive care. And let's face it, in memory issues, cognitive disorders, right now our pharmaceutical options are very limited and not necessarily dramatically effective. You know, it's like those old saying that the art of caring for a patient is caring for the patient, right? And there's their help, there's their surroundings are crucial parts of the care. So, and that's what makes, I think, geriatrics so much fun, is that we're dealing with people, not with organs. And so the success is defined by how that person is doing, not by what the cardiac output is necessarily. And it's the same even with cognitive issues.
I'm just wondering, in terms of your approach, obviously falls is a major one. You want to just go over some of the other of the geriatric giants? Because in some ways, if you make sure you focus on all of them, even if you don't intend to do a comprehensive geriatric assessment, you end up doing it. So for the viewers and participants, it would be nice to hear about the other of the giants.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, my best example of why it's so important to do have the ability to do a comprehensive assessment would be simple studies in heart failure clinics. So heart failure is a disease of older people predominantly. That and chronic obstructive lung disease are the commonest reasons why people get admitted to hospital in Canada. And if you do cognitive testing in a heart failure clinic, 50% of the people will have cognitive impairment. The first study was done at McMaster, but then there were follow-ups in the United States that showed exactly the same thing. So that means that if you don't, the current management of heart failure requires so many medications at different times of the day, that if you haven't done a cognitive assessment or screen, then you haven't taken care of the heart failure. And you know, a colleague of mine, Shabir Alibi, has shown the same thing in cancer therapy. If you don't take into effect all the other factors are going on, you might over-treat or under-treat elderly people with cancer. And without understanding the full complexity of their situation, you can't prescribe the right cancer therapy.
You know, I think, Barry, it's worth talking, because it's something we've both experienced from the early, early days, the issue of medication. And what I find interesting, because I know that it's always been my practice, but in my assessments, not only asking what drugs are you on, because you get a list, is figure out how are you taking your drugs? Like, what's the system involved? And I find, I mean, the range of stories is amazing. I am not a youngster myself. I'm on like 9 drugs, which I say basically have saved my life. And I know that I got to the point that even though I'm a doctor and I know I had to develop the use and require the use of a blister pack with a supplementary dosette to make sure that I had some way of remembering, and my memory is quite good, remembering that I took the afternoon drug, give or take a little in the afternoon. And I find many people, and you see it because they show evidence of cognitive impairment, that actually the list of drugs looks great and you don't know why there's a problem. But the reality is the list isn't an indication of how and what they're taking and how you know and what they're taking.
Absolutely right. Even simple things like taking a pill every other day, if it's not in a blister pack, that's impossible. You can't remember it after a couple of weeks. Was it yes? Because every day is the same for it. So, you know, either a blister pack for that kind of thing, or you can say, take it Monday, Wednesday, Friday, right?
That's right.
Most people know what day of the week it is.
But that's right, yeah.
And, you know, there was a big British study. Obviously, you can't quite randomize it, but they looked at people who were taking blister packs or pre-made dosettes versus elderly people versus those who are taking them out of the bottles. And the cognitive scores in the people who had the pre-filled dosettes or blister packs was much lower, but their adherence to the medication was much better because it was laid out for them. You know, we know that in randomized clinical trials where you've got intellectually fine people who are altruistic, you know, trying to help science, that the adherence is only about 80%, because they forget they're human beings, and that how you take it. And there's another complexity in what is that list really, what they're actually taking. So people, you know, that's one of the, when I started off in 1979, very few elderly people were taking non-prescription medications. Now it's only very few who aren't taking stuff that they bought and are adding to it. And even more interesting, we had one of our residents many years ago won our Tri-University Research Award for his study, which was he asked in his clinic, he asked people to bring in all their medications. So they brought in their shopping bags of the list. He wanted to see what they were actually taking and how they were taking it. He recorded that, and that was part one. Part two was a couple weeks later, he happened to be in their neighborhood, knocked on their door, and they were so pleased to see him. They invited him in for cookies and coffee or tea. And during while they were talking, he said, "I've forgotten what medications you're on. Can we just take a look at your pills?" And he found pills that were not brought in because they belonged to the person down the hall whose husband died, and his morphine, you know, was bequeathed to her. And, you know, and why would people not bring that in and say, because they know the doctor's going to yell at them for taking somebody else's sleeping pill or pain pill, so they don't mention it. So we have very little idea. Sometimes even if they brought it in, you think you know, unless you've done a home visit as well to observe how they do it. And we actually have some availability at Sinai of Rexall has donated the time of a home visiting pharmacist. And they go in, and I get this detailed report of how they're actually taking their medications and when they're taking it, and plus some very good recommendations of what can be altered. So my enfeebled brain can handle that very easily. But it's amazing how ignorant we are of what is actually happening in reality to our patients. And I'm like a lot of doctors. There's some of the medications, I don't know what they look like. So when they say, "Well, I take the pink pills at 3 p.m. Yeah. I don't know if that's the right one. The pharmacist does. They know the color and shape of every pill. Yeah. So when it's described to them, they can tell you what's happening.
Yeah. And I must say, that's in the good old days. I actually remember the way pills look, because I would look at them. Remember, we'd have people come in. We'd look at the pills. We'd look at the bottle. But with the generics, there's a whole issue, because they never quite, I'm not sure what the regulations are, but there was a challenge of whether generics could make the pill look like the trade, which they didn't. The trade companies didn't want the people making the system. It's better, because then people wouldn't mix up because the pill didn't look alike. But I just had experience this morning. I was filling up my Dosette that supplements my blister pack, and I take acetaminophen round the clock for a million kinds of pain because I'm no youngster. And my previous acetaminophen were round red pills. These are the Kirkland acetaminophen. I opened up the bottle, and now they're oblong white pills. Now, why they changed it, I have no idea, but I can tell you, for someone who takes a lot of pills, round pills are really easier to swallow than oblong pills. Right? They're easier to swallow.
And there are some interesting things that I think are, you know, system design is important, right? For example, we have a lot of people with rheumatological disorders who are on methotrexate, right?
Yes.
And methotrexate, the days you take it once a week, the other days you take folic acid to supplement, to counteract some of the side effects of the methotrexate. Both are tiny yellow pills that are indistinguishable.
Yes.
You know, that is a design flaw.
Well, I remember writing an article on a patient I saw, because you know me, I write an article about anything. Used to say every clinic I had at Baycrest, I had an article from it, because it was a case study, and then you expand. But this was somebody who had, interesting, had heart failure, so was on digoxin, furosemide, and was also taking diazepam of some sort. All three yellow pills. And the way the person came in, they were complaining of that they were very drowsy in the morning and were getting up all night to pee. And they said that they took the three pills appropriately, and on the top of the pills, on the container, they wrote morning, night. So I looked at the bottles, and because I still knew what pills looked like, I realized they were taking the furosemide at night and the diazepam in the morning. So that's why they were dopey in the morning and peeing all night. Well, can you imagine if you didn't look at that, the kind of workup you would end up doing, because they have nocturia. And if it was a male and nocturia, next thing you know, they've got a cystoscopy and a UTI for menstrual. You know, it's like the, as Paul O'Rashawn says, you know, the cascade of not figuring out, as I often say, when all else fails, you have to take a history. And a lot of times, unless you have the time to do it, you don't take a careful history, and that includes how are you taking your medication.
Yeah, and I'd like to hear your experience as well, but as a consultant geriatrician, things are often missed, not because they're so complex, but because an appropriate history and physical was not done. We have so many elderly patients have never had a proper physical examination.
Yeah.
And I think that is part of a comprehensive geriatric assessment. Simple things like doing the blood pressure lying and standing, doing a neurological examination. And unfortunately, the ability of non-neurologists to do a neurological examination, I think, has deteriorated over the years. We rely on the CT scan and the MRI,
yes,
and they don't tell us everything. And also not available and delayed, particularly MRIs you don't get for a while. The skill level, you know, as I'm older, I don't want to run in clinic. I don't want to run between rooms. So if possible, I try, if it's not too busy, I sit in with a resident or a student and can correct their mistakes in physical examinations. Some of them are just really have no idea how to do a proper neurological examination, which is a crucial part of examining old people. Yeah. What I find interesting is I also get a lot of physician assistant students from McMaster. And when I observe them, they can actually do a better neurological examination than most of our senior residents. They're not expected to come up with diagnoses. They're simply to provide data for the doctor they're working with. So they view the process not as a necessary evil to get to the end, but the process as their end. And so they put a lot more effort into their neurological examination than our young doctors do often. So, which is a concern for me.
I remember a wonderful TED talk I saw by the author and surgeon Abraham Varghese, who wrote the book Cutting for Stone. And he's actually a brilliant lecturer. But this was a TED talk, and he actually studied in Glasgow. So it resonated with me because I studied in Dundee, University of St. Andrews. And he was talking to a class in Glasgow, and he was talking about, now it wasn't geriatrics per se, but it was relevant, about the importance of the history and examination. And he told a history that really resonated with me in Scotland, that he knew the patient, where they came from, what they did, what kind of work, by a number of factors. Their accent, I knew that in Dundee, because those who worked in the jute mills had a very specific accent because they were partially deaf from the noise of the mills, because they never wore ear protectors. He knew that she walked to the clinic through a sort of a muddy land by the mud on her shoes. And there was a whole bunch of things. And she said, and then he talked about the physical examination and what had to be done. And then he showed a picture of the contemporary physical examination, which was seven people looking at a computer screen.
And he has an older TED talk on just the physical examination, which I advise my residents to look up, because when they're starting listening to stuff through this close, I say,
telling
the patient that they're not important enough to even lift up their shirt so you can listen to the heart.
That's right.
Clearly.
No.
And Varghese makes that point beautifully in that earlier one that's just on the physical examination. But, you know, even the stethoscope has mythical powers for lay people.
I know.
And if you do it through the clothes, you're saying it's not important.
No, no. And it really is. I mean, even though I'm a little bit deaf these days, and I had to resurrect my old stethoscope when I started working again, and I I was shocked when the first day in the clinic, I couldn't hear anything. And this is an interesting example that we see, but I was experiencing, I couldn't hear anything. So I went to my audiologist, because I have hearing aids. I said, is there anything they can put onto the hearing aids to amplify? She said, well, not really. You could buy a very expensive hearing, audio stethoscope that is really my amplifier. I said, well, I'm not spending $600. She said, well, let me have a look in your ears. She said, well, of course you can't hear. You're full of wax. Now, think about the number of people we see. I have, and I'm willing to bet you do in your office, a pocket talker. Because you have lots of people and they say, my hearing's fine. But you know, when you're speaking to them, and this is something we don't get taught unless we're doing it, is you can tell they have a hearing apartment because as they talk to you, they're turning their ear to you, their good ear. And I say, is your hearing fine? They say, yes. I said, well, let's try this. And I put on this pocket talker. And they say, oh my God. And half the time, nobody's looked in their ears to see if they have wax because not every doctor, one, likes to pull wax out. A lot of them don't, and I understand why. It's not easy. And some people have to go to their audiologist to do it. But these are such simple things that have such a profound effect on a person's function. And I've had people who I would say were semi-misdiagnosed, because it wasn't all of it, of cognitive impairment, because they really weren't hearing. And I used to say, if you didn't hear it, you can't remember it.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about that. And during COVID, when I was wearing masks and face protectors, yes. Not only did that decrease their hearing, those people had been partially deaf for a long time, even if they didn't realize they were becoming adept at lip reading and they couldn't see their lips. So all of a sudden, it became almost impossible to do proper cognitive testing.
Yes, yes. It was very, very important. So the question is, how do we, translate what we now do, I would say, as our routine, certainly for the first time you see a new patient. When somebody's referred to us, and I would say, even though I'm not working in a geriatric center, I'm working in a memory clinic, I work on the assumption that for me, it's a geriatric assessment with a special focus on cognition. Because when I was in Baycrest, most of my referrals to the geriatric clinic, I'd say 80% were for cognitive impairment. Okay? Whereas in the old days, I'd get people with heart failure, with this and that. So it's not that different. So how do we get this? It's so technologically unsophisticated, and we're so used now to teaching technology. How do we get this projected onto our younger trainees?
Good question, because there is ample evidence. I was looking at it a couple months ago when I was doing a review for the chief coroner's office, and there's ample evidence that you can structure family medicine, primary care, to do much better job on assessing older people. So it's not that we don't have bright people who are not geriatricians who couldn't do a lot of it. The structure of their practice, the lack of other people in the practice, allied health, the lack of remuneration for doing a proper job, all add up together. So it's not a matter of convincing specific doctors that they've got to do a better job. It's a matter of how do we change the system so that primary care is rewarded and has the tools to do this? The doctors we're training have all of the cognitive and technical abilities theoretically to do it. We've just got to organize a system for it. We know that, family doctors who get special training and organize themselves and do fabulous jobs on family practice organized memory clinics, right, throughout the province. Are not enough geriatricians and neurologists to help. And they do a great job. We have great evidence for that. So it's a matter of figuring out how we change the system to reward those kind of activities. And obviously, as the number of older people increase, that is important. We know that older people who get proper assessment and over the next year or two cost the health system less because they don't end up in a hospital or emergency room. So it's as our demographics alter, it's becoming more and more important to change the system to do it. And you know, in my all my years in medicine, whenever there's a crisis, you know, basically it's give us more money and we'll do the same thing, slightly expanded.
Yeah.
And that hasn't really worked well. That's, you know, Einstein's definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And we that's all we do is provinces ask the federal government for more money and we do the same thing. And somehow we've got to figure out a different system of care that accepts the fact that times have changed.
I'm just curious what you think about, this is a little off topic, but I wonder if it might fit in. So they're talking about I think it's a new medical school. I don't know if it's the one at Toronto Metropolitan or the other one, that they're going to primarily train people to be family doctors, right?
Right.
Isn't there
that's going to be the new one at York University has that. But I think
York. Okay.
Yeah, but there's an undercurrent for the one that's for Metropolitan Toronto University. That campus is going to be in Brampton. I think that's a subtext. But let me remind you, Michael, when I was in medical school was when John Evans went and created the new school at McMaster. The first graduating class wasn't up to 100. They only had 22 people. 21 went into specialties and subspecialties, even though McMaster was built to provide family doctors. So
yeah.
And what did they do? Of course, they hired great scientists from England, mostly, to head departments and stuff who were phenomenal researchers and immediately made McMaster a great academic institution. But of course, the role models for family medicine were not there.
No, it's interesting because I remember some of the very early graduates of McMaster who were in family medicine, and I'm still in touch with them, and they were among the very best family medicine, but they were very few of them. So I'm just curious because I've been asked if I would review applicants for the geriatric family medicine extra year or whatever they're doing at TMU, because my name was put forward as somebody because I used to supervise the care of the elderly trainees at Baycrest. They did the clinic with me. I had a particular interest in that realm rather than the geriatric trainees because there were enough people who wanted to do them. So TMU seems to have been committed to a program to train people in the third year or the whatever the extra year is for care of the elderly.
Well, I hope that, you know, that program has produced some fabulous people. One of the problems, though, is that there's such a need for them in long-term care facilities that a lot of their times, and it's well-used time, but there aren't enough of them when you consider the tasks that we would like them to do.
Yeah, and certainly the ones that I've worked with either at Baycrest or ones who've gone elsewhere, some of whom went through the training program, so I knew them, usually divide their time between some long-term care, some ambulatory care, some hospital care, and they actually do, especially in areas where they don't have geriatricians, they end up doing it.
You know,
some or if they have one geriatrician for a whole hospital, they end up doing a lot of the heavy lifting.
And they do a good job. The issue is also, though, that standard geriatricians that we're used to have that core base of internal medicine, so that understanding some of the acute diseases that we're better at, I think, than the care of the elderly. And so we need a mix of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Anyway, I think we've covered the subject quite well. So the real takeaway message is for those of us who are interested in and want to stimulate young trainees to go into geriatrics, besides the wonderful stories that you hear and the challenges, the fact that we now are supported by the ministry to actually do the kind of medicine that we all wish we could do, because one of the complaints I hear from doctors, I don't have enough time to do all that. I've seen notices at doctor's offices, one complaint at a time. Can you imagine doing care of the elderly, geriatrics, one complaint at a time? So was it today, Mrs. Green? I've got constipation. Okay, but I can't breathe up. I'm not doing breathing today. Breathing is another appointment.
Well, an interesting historical note, I first brought up to Ontario Medical Association, their tariff committee, when I was president of the OMA section on geriatrics in the 1980s, that we should get, for our consultations, we needed more money because of all the functional assessments. It was the orthopods who blocked it at that time, because we do a functional assessment, we see if they can walk. You shouldn't get any extra money. And it was a family doctor who was very interested in geriatrics, who worked at the old Queen Elizabeth Hospital, a classmate of mine, Chris Stefanovich, who is the hero of this story. And Chris says, Barry, you've done it wrong. You don't ask for money. You ask first for a special code. When they realize how little it's going to cost them, then they'll give you the money. And so he, the next year, rather than me going to the tariff committee, he did it because he knew how to stick handle through that. He got us a special code, no extra money at that time, but the special code. And but having that special code for a geriatric comprehensive assessment changed the things until, and the government has been very responsive. They actually sort of forced the OMA into accepting that they would get more geriatricians to get more money for a comprehensive assessment. And so it's a family doctor. He would call him care of the elderly because he had tremendous experience with older people and did house calls on his way home every night, you know, for his older patients. But Chris was the hero, a family doctor, the hero for what geriatricians got for comprehensive geriatric assessment.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you, Barry. We've, as I often say, a lot of water has gone under our two bridges. Having grown up in New York City, you had the Manhattan Bridge and the Brooklyn Bridge next to each other. And that's how I feel about our careers. I think I was built first and you were soon after. Is that
the next year after you?
That's right.
I'm certified.
And that's the history of the Brooklyn Bridge was the first one. And I actually had a professor in Dundee who I went to see, and he told me that his father went to New York, to Brooklyn, to help build the Brooklyn Bridge. So we made our connection. So anyway, thank you very much for joining us and again for sharing your wisdom and experience with all the participants of Health Flex's podcast series.
A pleasure. Bye, everybody.